This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything that Rich, Tom and myself have been up to on a Friday morning. That includes looking at the wildly successful first day of trading for Parkin, up 35% at the close. We've been speaking to one of the lawyers behind it, Andrew Tarbuck, partner and head of capital markets at Al-Tamimi & Co., once again to ask the question, who might be next? Plus, Apple. Back in the firing range, this time from America's DOJ. We've been speaking to the tech journalist Kevin Sebastian. And we've been speaking to one passport expert, Jeremy Savory, about how the passport's becoming less of a travel document and more of an investment tool. All of that on the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Richard Dean, a tale of two tech stories.
Yes, that's right. Do you want the good or the bad?
I want the ugly.
I thought you might. It's Apple. And it's being sued. It's our top story this morning, or one of our top stories. It's also one of Serena's top stories this morning. And you know when the worlds of business and news collide that it's a big story. This is Merrick Garland. He's the Attorney General in the United States, giving a press conference yesterday. This is him in his own words about why the Department of Justice is suing Apple.
Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market, not simply by staying ahead of the competition on the merits, but by violating federal antitrust law. Consumers should not have to pay higher prices because companies break the law. We allege that Apple has employed a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers.
And so he continued for about 25 minutes outlining the case. It's mainly to do with the iPhone. We know Apple does a bunch of stuff, but iPhone is more than half its sales. And he makes the point that Apple has grown to be a company whose annual turnover is bigger than the GDP of more than 100 countries. And he says it has done that partly through fair means, but also partly through foul means as well. And locking people into the iPhone ecosystem and locking others out. He says the wallet is a big part of it. It gets quite technical. Of course it does. It's a tech company. But in general, philosophically, are we Team Apple or Team Department of Justice on this one?
Do you know, I can see both sides on this. Technically what you're employed to do. So the DOJ has gone over after all of the biggies, right? So we've had Meta, we've had Google, I think it's Edwards with Amazon. You need someone to be doing that, full stop. You do, it's a checks and balance, right?
It is. Yeah, that's why you have regulation, particularly antitrust regulation. And we know all of this dates back to the oil companies 100, 150 years ago and the monopolies they had and the pricing power that gave them over oil. That's where the whole antitrust movement in the United States came from. And it's been applied to various industries. And tech, of course, is very much in focus at the moment. Tom, Team Apple, Team Department of Justice?
I get it. I just don't see what they're going to get out of it.
Well, that actually is the big one, because we see the European Union does this and has done to tech companies since I was a young, very young reporter, and that was mainly Microsoft in those days, because it's always the gorillas that are the ones who end up at the sort of the focus of these kind of investigations. I've already lost track, I think, of what Apple is being investigated by various parties and for various things, whether it's the App Store, whether it's visibility for customers to be able to see other options, blah, blah, blah. But I do think people also need to be doing it. Does it cost a lot of time and money? Yes. Does Apple have a lot of money? Yeah, we're all right. I think it needs to happen. I'm not sure, though, and I agree with Tom here, how much effect it actually has.
They're not going to shut them down, are they?
Well, they might split them up. They might split them up. That's one thought that they could...
Into slices.
They could slice and dice the Apple. Very good. Yeah. But what would you do with the core?
Oh. Core's rotten.
The core is not rotten, says Apple. They say they will vigorously fight the lawsuit and deny the claims that have been made. I'm Team Apple on this one. They've built a moat. That's what you're supposed to do as a company. Build moats. Build something that will protect your product. Differentiate it. Protect it from competition. Build barriers to entry.
You say that.
They've done that.
And yet, we all have Apple devices. And one of the reasons that we have Apple devices is because we can't get out of the system for various reasons. You paid. It used to be that you'd paid for your music and your music was there, and that was one of the reasons that people didn't want to leave the Apple universe, because you'd effectively got sunk costs. Mm. You had your entire record collection effectively on one of these. Now you don't, because, you know, streaming and everything else, so that's kind of gone. But even if you wanted a better camera, you don't leave the universe, because you're either Richard Dean, who goes off and buys a Samsung and then drives us all nuts because he can't figure out how to turn it off for about 3 weeks, and radio listeners get to hear various bits and pieces from Richard's phone when unintended, or you've just got it too plugged into your laptop and everything else you do.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm part of the herd. I just follow the herd. It's just easier for me and things like that. It's one of those ones. Yeah, okay, they might slice it up. Maybe that's going to come. They're probably just going to wrap their knuckles with a fine that is just 0.01% of a day's earnings or something like that. But give them a bit of a rap on the hands, etc. They are too influential. You make a really valid point about, you know, back in the day it was the oil companies. Probably everyone knew that they were doing wrong per se, or not doing everything in the common interests, and trust issues might have been an issue, but things were getting done and revenue was being made, and the majority of people were happy with what they got. Okay, they need to be called into line every now and again. And it's the tech companies nowadays, isn't it? They are the new behemoths of industry.
They're the new Rockefellers. Yeah. What have the Rockefellers ever done for us? Yeah, they got stinking rich. America is still today, 100 years later, the world's biggest oil producer.
Mm.
And that is a legacy of Standard Oil and a lot of stuff they did. And were they perfect? Hell no. And yeah, I argue that, you know, you could say that that America is still the world's biggest oil producer. You could maybe even argue that's because Standard Oil was split up and they created antitrust laws. But I am wary to criticise big business for being big.
But this is my point. It's a philosophical thing more than anything else. Given that we are all three of us hooked in the Apple universe, we should absolutely want regulators to be doing their best to try and keep them on the straight and narrow. Because even just the time and energy that it takes for these guys to fight these lawsuits, it doesn't change anything in public opinion. We're not sitting there thinking, oh, a bit nasty, might change phones. But if it just prompts people to do better, that alone surely is people who are hooked on these devices we should want.
Well, then, yeah. I
realise that's a bit starry-eyed, but you know what I'm saying.
I do take your point. The other point is, if we're so... Okay, we're Apple customers, we're locked in, we can't change. I tried going Android a couple of years ago. It was a disaster.
I tried to use someone's Android phone the other day. I can't even... I couldn't even pull up a
they're,
camera.
They're brilliant.
Fingers and thumbs, yeah.
I know. Utterly ridiculous.
They're brilliant. I just don't speak the language.
Where's the app button?
But yes.
Hey, Siri.
Siri!
Yeah, it was dreadful. But look, if you think, okay, I really like Apple products, or I'm stuck in this ecosystem, so I can't get out. When you buy an iPhone for, I don't know, $1,000, whatever it costs, buy $1,000 worth of Apple shares as well. Then you're hedged, because then you're getting some of the profit that Apple is making.
Even if you live in a nice part of town, you still want there to be police.
Oh, yeah. You've got me there.
Listeners agreeing at
floored
the moment.
Floored with the left.
Archana says, such lawsuits create awareness more than anything, similar to the lawsuits against Meta and Facebook. Archana, thank you very much indeed. Do keep your opinions coming on. So we only scratched the surface. We only did the bad and the ugly, and we haven't done the good yet. We've got good coming your way in just a few moments' time. In fact, two good stories with regards to market influence, both from the US and here in the UAE. We'll get the latest on the Reddit story and the latest from Parkin, which has had an extraordinary 24 hours. That's all
Shabir's
coming your way.
Shabir's just
in
called
a
few us minutes. Sheep.
Don't be sheep.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, and everyone in the market talking about Parkin shares yesterday, which were up by just over 35% on their first day as a listed company. We are joined now by one of the lawyers who has worked on many IPOs, including that one. Andrew Tarbuck, partner and head of capital markets at Altamimi, doesn't so much have the T-shirt as is wearing the Parkin badge this morning.
Absolutely, completely on brand for you, Brandy. So morning and hello, Tom.
Your loyalty's not in question. Right, what can we take from Parkin's first day as a listed company and that stock gaining about a third?
I think it just shows the strength of the Dubai privatisation process and the popularity of such good issuers. The Parkin business has been spun out of the RTA. You know, it's proved to be a great business in the eyes of investors. And what's interesting is there was incredible demand during the IPO itself. But obviously in the secondary market, you know, split second after the listing and the bell rings, there's a ton of investors that want to buy in. And that's an indication of, you know, the number of subscriptions, applications was so high during the actual IPO offer period itself that the activity in the aftermarket is huge. And people are just trying to buy in, want more and more and more. So, a really good story. Great story for Dubai. Great story for the Dubai privatization process as well.
Right. So, couple of questions for you. And as one of the lawyers, you're kind of less on the share trading side and more on the mechanics of putting the IPO together side. It had the first price stabilization mechanism on the DFM, though, and I will ask you to talk me through that.
Yeah, okay. So a price stabilization mechanism is a very, very common mechanism used in developed markets. So you see this in the US, Europe. It's also called a green shoe option, which is basically where there is a facility to support the share price post-IPO for a certain designated period. So it's a 30-day period after the listing date. And what that means is that if the share price dips below the offer price, there is a mechanism in place where there's an arrangement with a broker that they can buy in the market to actually support the share price, which is obviously good for investors so that you know there's not so much volatility in the share price post-IPO. So in this case, with a share price that's up, you know, by 30% in the first day, yeah, you know, the chances of using the price stabilization mechanism on this particular IPO are very low. But, you know, you never know. I mean, hopefully we don't get to that point. But it's there to just assist the market. The markets themselves are actually very encouraging of this process because it allows, you know, the stabilization agent to actually step in and make that sort of share price less volatile if there is volatility.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like we actually had the opposite problem. Gulf News reporting this morning that, in fact, some third-party platforms were struggling to cope with the demand. So the retail tranche is the one that interests us the most because that's what the majority of people listening and ourselves fall into. Like many of the other IPOs that we have seen, it was increased. It was increased from 10 to 12% of the offering.
Yeah.
But still mammothly oversubscribed. People were getting a fraction of what they put down and what they wanted. Why don't you guys, when you're planning this out, put in larger retail tranches?
I think because, you know, the size of these IPOs, it's about sort of availability for shares for all sorts of investors. And you've seen that 10% raised to 12%. And that's really because you can't gauge the retail demand as well as you can necessarily the institutional demand. So the retail comes in and then you can make an assessment to actually increase it. So it's about sort of allocating shares between the tranches. And, you know, look, that's where the bankers really earn their money. But from a sort of ethical point of view, if you like, you know, you try and be as fair as you can to all investors and, you know, make sure that retail is properly catered for, not just institutional. So, but you're seeing that there is this move towards more and more retail, and which is fine. And, you know, I think the idea is from a company is you want liquidity in the stock. So, you know, it's good to have retail trade as well as institutional investors on your cap table. So,
yeah. And I mean, and to play devil's advocate on that, you don't want people to look at an IPO and think, there's no point, I'm going to end up with 7.5 shares.
Yeah, and that's the balance, right? I mean, but the thing is, the retail is so in demand that trying to keep everybody happy, and that's why you have the guaranteed minimum allocation, because that's another point in the offer process. We actually put a guaranteed minimum application for a retail application, which is, you know, I know a sort of a small-ish amount, but at least it guarantees that if you have made an application, you will get that amount. Obviously, you need to apply for more than the guaranteed minimum.
We're more than halfway through the expected number of government privatisations. Parkin was number six out of 10. What other public sector businesses or areas of activity make sense to you?
That's obviously the really hot question right now, which is what are the next potential candidates coming down the track? And I think it's really, first of all, I don't know is the honest answer. And I'm not sort of sitting back, you know, being all loyally and refusing to comment. But it's more looking at candidates that have a good financial track record. They're solid, you know, and one of the things that's been very interesting is all of these Dubai privatizations have shown good dividend payouts. And so being able to pay dividends is another sort of key feature for a potential issuer. So as far as the Department of Finance, and now it's Dubai Investment Fund, now is the selling shareholder in the Dubai government privatizations, which is a new feature actually of this particular IPO. They will just be looking at key candidates that literally have a good, solid financial track record, well-governed, and are just ready to become a listed company. And that's an ongoing process at the Department of Finance. So no real solid answer for you, Brandy, but it's in the train.
Well, if we look at the private sector, we've got Bloomberg reporting the last 24 hours that Lulu has appointed some bankers. We keep shaking Tom Harvey every time he comes in of spinnies to see if any news will fall
does
out
he rattle?
Of him.
Does he rattle?
One of the reasons for this IPO train is to get more private sector activity, more family businesses and the rest on the markets. Is that happening quickly enough?
I think one thing is for sure is the outreach around family businesses and private issuers is huge. I mean, at Al Tamimi, we actually support the DFM, Dubai Financial Market, in looking at its sort of IPO accelerator program, which is all designed to look at maybe small to medium caps and family businesses. Now, there is just, you know, still that sort of hesitation. The market itself is doing its job. It's a great market now to come to market. And the amount of family businesses that are really looking at it is definitely increased. But the message that we would always say to family businesses and private issuers is, you know, at the end of the day, you may not even be suitable to IPO, but they're asking the question. And that's I think, you know, we're down the track there.
Andrew Tarbuck, partner and head of capital markets at Al Tamimi, one of the men working on one of the lawyers working on the IPO from Parkin. If you're watching him on television, you will see that he is even sporting the badge after that first day of trading in which Parkin shares raised by 35%. Thank you very much for your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's get a bit more on those two big tech stories now. Going to bring in Kevin Sebastian, who's a tech journalist based here in Dubai. Morning, Kevin.
Morning.
We'll get onto Reddit in a second and Donald Trump's plans for a $3 billion stock market listing. First off, though, we have to start with Apple, the US filing a landmark lawsuit against Apple, which accuses the tech giant of monopolizing the smartphone market and crushing competition. Have a listen to Merrick Garland. He's the US Attorney General. This is what he had to say.
For consumers, that has meant fewer choices, higher prices and fees, lower quality smartphones, apps, and accessories, and less innovation from Apple and its competitors. For developers, that has meant being forced to play by rules that insulate Apple from competition. And as outlined in our complaint, we allege that Apple has consolidated its monopoly power, not by making its own products better, but by making other products worse.
Kevin, is he right, or is this just lawyers and politicians grandstanding to get the spotlight for themselves?
So this is a bit of a yes and no situation because let's understand the context of what just happened, right? Apple, in a very shocking turn of events, is now facing an antitrust lawsuit in their own home ground. And this is something even I wouldn't have seen coming, but they have been fighting a lot of fines and cases in the EU, which has been going on a quite regular basis. So to see that this has happened in the US has been quite a very big landmark case in itself, because let's get to the facts here. Apple's very well known for its very walled garden approach. Like, if you enter Apple's ecosystem, you play by their rules, and most of the ecosystem is locked in. And in fact, we have seen in the way that they do their business marketing as well, a lot of what they do is proprietary. even their charging cables, their chargers, you have to buy them separately. Obviously, Apple says this, it's in the name of environmental safety. But that's the thing, though, because you're buying separate things, whereas in the EU, they are now forced to come up, and this year's next iPhone will have a USB-C connection as well. And this is partly because the EU is trying to reduce on environmental waste so that they're going to standardize all cables. Now, coming to the case, to say that Apple is a monopoly is not too far of a stretch, because let's look into the other things that Apple are also doing besides hardware and software. They're also become an entertainment company as well. And it's funny that we just heard that they're saying that they're having a walled garden approach and they're reducing competition, because that's exactly what Apple has been doing in the EU, where just recently, and this is something I've even come up on the show and spoken about, is about the fact that they had to fight with Epic Games to get Fortnite on Apple, and they had to go through a mammoth lawsuit literally just to make that happen in the EU. So that is, it is, again, a very big surprise as well, but I think Apple are going to be fighting this tooth and nail, because this is their home ground now. And the fact that this news comes out, it means that Apple literally have to like prove to themselves why they deserve a 30% commission on app sales in their store.
Apple saying, "We believe the lawsuit is wrong on the facts and wrong on the law, and we will vigorously defend against it." Could Apple be split up? That's one suggestion being put by various lawyers, including Professor Rebecca Allensworth at Vanderbilt University in the United States.
I do not think that they would go as far as to split the company in different in sizes, because we already know that's going to be happening with TikTok, with that bill being passed. But with Apple, on the other hand, I believe they're probably going to adopt a model which is very similar to what the EU is going on. So EU has the Digital Markets Act, making the gatekeepers allow for better competition, which is what has been going on in the EU. So I fully expect the DOJ to basically give Apple that same option, where they would be allowing to have third-party marketplaces and diminishing the exclusivity of the Apple App Store, its monopoly at least, and the fact that they allow them to install other apps as well within the ecosystem. However, will Apple allow that? That's basically why you buy Apple, right? Because at the end of the day, when Apple promises to have making good software, it just works. That's the all great phrase that they get into. But it's going to be a very very long and drawn-out fight here, because I do not expect Apple to divisively build up their, you know, cut out their company that they've built for so many years. They do want to maintain their market dominance, especially in the US market.
Well, let's talk about that. US market, they are dominant. 65 to 70% of the smartphone market is what Merrick, the Attorney General, said Apple has at the moment. Not so elsewhere, though. Here in the Middle East, it's Android country, is it not, Kevin?
So let's look at the UAE, specifically the UAE and Saudi. We do see that Apple has a deep prominence. However, keep in mind, given the large expatriate population, we do see trickles of Android systems over here, as well as other systems from Huawei as well. So this is a very specific US thing, but it does have far-reaching global consequences, because we already have been talking about issues, especially with the how messages are being made with as far as Apple's messaging system is going. So say, for example, you're sending a message from your Android phone and they have to pick it up at iMessage. Sometimes some of the images don't load well and the functionalities don't come out fully as well. So this is something that the DOJ is looking very, very closely into, because, again, the US DOJ is looking at what Europe is saying, and they're going to apply that in the sense of a Monopoly Act. And it's basically, we're seeing all global governments now realize, and this is like a trend I fully expect to continue for the next 5 years, where they're going after big tech companies and looking at the way they dominate markets right now. So currently, we are looking at TikTok facing its own one of its biggest audiences suddenly like face the issue of sell off the company or don't operate anymore. I don't think they can do that to Apple as well. So this is an American product at the end of the day, and I'm pretty sure that the DOJ will find some way of concession, and Tim Cook is going to definitely cook up something that allows them to, a light slap on the wrist is how I'm going to put it in this situation.
Right, let's talk Reddit. Another big tech story making headlines yesterday. The stock market debut was a spectacular success for Reddit, the social media company, up 70% at one stage, closing nearly 50% higher at the end of trading yesterday. But actually, the Reddit story I want to ask you about is one of the stocks that's being tipped on Reddit at the moment, and that is Donald Trump's media empire. Now, reports suggest that Donald Trump could make about $3 billion next week if his media company, effectively Truth Social, his social media company, lists through a so-called SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Company. And we know Donald Trump needs the money at the moment. I don't want to get into the technicalities of what that IPO might look like, but just take a step back. How on earth could Truth Social, niche social media company, does about $5 million a year in ad revenue, how could it be worth $3 billion, Kevin?
That's the grand question everyone's been asking right now. So the SPAC is basically called Digital World Acquisition, and it is promoting itself as a very pro-Republican, pro-conservative media, which talks about like the whole vanguard of how journalism used to be. And that's what they're trying to push to investors, saying that this is the reason why it's going to be doing well. Now, there is a small hitch in that plan, because the planned vote is also based on a sponsor called ARK Global Investments, which is trying to delay the deal to back this merger. And the reason why we are seeing Trump inflate this figure, because he has several lawsuits to pay off. In fact, he has to actually pay off a $454 million lawsuit by a New York judge. Now, if there's anything that we've known about Trump, specifically in the recent times, is that he maintains that he's worth several billion dollars. He's still in the running for the U.S. presidency. And it is insane that despite everything that has happened to him, he still has not been taken down fully.
Kevin, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Fascinating conversation. Appreciate your thoughts this morning. Kevin Sebastian, independent tech journalist, joining us on a flurry of tech stories. More on Reddit to come at 20 past nine with one venture capital investor.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk citizenship, global or otherwise. Let's talk residency as well. Why? Because no big surprise that high net worth individuals from strong economies around the world are looking for options at the moment, as their financial centres, as we've been discussing just a few minutes ago, suffer under higher taxes. A number of them are now increasingly viewing citizenship and residency as a potential investment, similar to owning multiple properties or diversifying their portfolio. To give us an indication of this one, we've been joined by the CEO and the founder of Savory and Partners, offices worldwide, headquartered here in Dubai. Jeremy Savory joins us live here in the studio. Jeremy, lovely to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the passport, the physicality of a passport these days as well. You know, for years we've kept them in socks drawers around the world, etc. And now, are we viewing them differently? I refer back to that the conversation we were just having about the Henley Index came out, the Henley Passport Index, etc., rates passports, etc. Is the power of a passport changing at the moment? Are we looking at passports differently?
I believe so, yes. I think I've been doing this for over a decade. When it started out, it was typically persons who would, really need to have a second nationality for facilitating their life and mainly geared towards freedom of travel. Although recently, especially since the elections in the US with Trump, we've started to see a lot of Americans, which historically you wouldn't see. Why would they be interested? But suddenly now you're seeing a lot of Americans applying. But we're getting a much wider range of nationalities. We've got, Turkmen, Uzbek, Indian, why are we getting so many more nationalities than we used to? I would say that now we're moving away from something that's a simple travel document to something that is a little bit more profound as a way to feel safe at night, because there's rising nationalism all around the world. I mean, this year we have more conflicts than we've ever had historically. We've got more elections in major countries than historically. It's a lot of turbulence. And I think a lot of people are looking at this more about the concept of sovereignty and am I in control of my future? Am I in control of my destiny? Because ultimately you're not. In whichever country you were born, you have obtained the nationality, the first one you have, that dictates all your future. And people don't like that lack of, that someone has a monopoly over their decisions and their future.
So people are looking at passports now, not just as you say, as a travel document, but an investment tool.
Exactly. An investment tool, a diversification tool. I would say another things have influenced this thought process as well, apart from obviously the nationalism and the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty, but people wanting to be able to take control of their life.
Right.
But I would say something else that has happened in the last, I'd say 12 months, is that such a product to be able to invest in a certain country legally and obtain a second nationality that lasts for multiple generations is becoming more and more scarce. You know, at one point we had about 11 countries that would do it. Now you've only got 8. If you look at all the EU countries, they've all either closed up shop or increasing the prices. The Greek parliament announced yesterday that they're going to increase the threshold up to 800,000 euros. Portugal already increased the threshold. Turkey increased the price of its citizenship. So I would say that a lot of people are doing it now because this is probably going to be the last chance.
Is there a change in trends as well at the moment? I mean, for many years, I remember when I first got here and the demand for Canadian citizenship was very, very high. There was that well-worn trodden path. People knew the process they had to go to gain their Canadian citizenship. Hearing grumbles now amongst those that either have gained that citizenship or otherwise. Have other countries sort of gone up those rankings as well? Are we seeing a shift in trends of where people are migrating to? Yeah,
very much so, Tom. I see that we're going back in the opposite direction. I'd say typically you would have seen the global south, so to speak, would be looking to obtain the nationalities of North America, Canada, the US, UK. The UK has essentially closed a lot of its options. The only ones left extremely difficult. America, obviously, the threshold for EB-5 went from 500 to 800,000, and people also are not feeling too welcome. So now I feel that we could have a reversal of the tide where you would have a lot of those nationalities in those Western democracies, Europe being another case, where they're saying, well, actually, this is not the way I like to see the future. I would like to have something else which allows me to have some kind of protection or safety, diversification. Some of it is, you know, citizenship is not always the way to fix tax, but it's definitely a very prudent tool in order to move towards residencies and tax residencies. Banking being another case in point. I mean, I was at my bank in DIFC a couple of days ago, and then they just said, oh, you just need to sign this FATCA form. You know, and then when you understand that a lot of the challenges that are facing Americans, but I feel that other countries are moving that direction. Australia are moving towards taking little steps to go towards tax on citizenship. So all these things are coming. So people are taking steps now to make the most of something that may not be around in years to come, but also because this is something that will impact your next generation, your legacy.
Got about a minute left just on this one. Talk to me about the UAE passport as well. We often talk about it going up the rankings as well, the demand for it. It's a conversation amongst those that are residents here in the region as well. Is that gaining a in popularity and power?
Well, it depends. It's not something that people can actually acquire. I mean, it's something that is definitely extremely attractive. I mean, the work that they've been doing, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in arranging more and more countries to access visa-free has propelled it to the top of most indices. I mean, there's actually a few indices, and depends which one you go to. Yeah. Some say Singapore is the best. Some say that France is the best. It really depends. But it's definitely becoming, I think it's more the power of the branding of the UAE itself, as much as it is the passport itself and the benefits.
Can't thank you enough for your time. I know it's a busy time for you and the team at Savoring Partners. So thanks so much indeed. And especially with the school holidays just around the corner as well. Jeremy, really appreciate your time this morning. Jeremy Savory is the CEO and the founder of Savory and Partners. Joining us live here in the studio. Thanks so much indeed for being
thank
with
you.
Us.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.